for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down on the down from the outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome to our program, and CRN Digital. Boy, lots in the news today. As we go through our program today, Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, he claims that this administration thinks torture is not torture. Are you confused? I am, too. We're going to find out about that on our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. Does Nazi Christianity have chilling parallels to today? We're going to have a guest who's going to be talking about that. Did Bill O'Reilly call for a full-body search of a female employee? And why has Tom DeLay asked to see a Texas convict's escape plan? Could it be for future use? We'll find out. Our quote for the day, our theme for the day, if we measure our country's greatness by how well we take care of our sick, poor, and old, where do we stand? And those in prison and the environment who can't even speak. Our quote for the day from Mahatma Gandhi, the measure of a country's greatness should be based on how well it cares for its most vulnerable populations. A little later on the program, we're going to get into what's happening with politics. Just very quickly, probably the big news, obviously, the Democrats took the gubernatorial elections in two eastern states. They're scattered throughout the country, various interesting little electoral pieces. The one story I thought was perhaps most interesting, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. This is from the Los Angeles Times. Of course, his ballot initiatives went down in defeat. He showed up at his Brentwood neighborhood polling station today to cast his ballot in the special election and was told he had already voted. Yes, the electronic voting machine that Arnie was trying to vote on had already recorded that Arnold had already voted on it back on October 25th. So, go figure. Anyhow, they're trying to figure that one out. And as Kim Alexander, president of the nonpartisan California Voter Foundation, says, if the governor is going to have a mix-up on his ballot, that, of course, would be his electronic voting machine ballot, it will make other voters wonder what is going on with their ballots. So we'll get into all of that today. But first, I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me Daniel Quinn. And those of you who are fans of his work or knowledgeable of his work, have read his books, this is your opportunity. If you've ever had a question that you'd like to ask the guy who wrote Ishmael, My Ishmael, The Story of Bee, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-THOM. And Daniel Quinn, welcome to the program.
Very glad to be here.
I'm very glad to have you here. You have a new book out. It's called Tales of Adam. Following on the themes that you developed in Ishmael, My Ishmael, The Story of Bee, Beyond Civilization.
Yes.
And the Tales of Adam begin where?
Begin with all the tales are tales of Adam. The Adam of Genesis with his son Abel, their adventures as Adam tries to convey to him his worldview, his view of how things work in the world and what's going on in the world.
Now, I found in Ishmael, in My Ishmael, in The Story of Bee and Beyond Civilization, in your other books, consistently, although you by and large seem to be going back into what might be referred to as prehistory and before what you call the Great Forgetting insights, but there's always a here's what this means for us and now in there, even when it's subtle or implied. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong in that. That's my what I carried away from your books was that there's always a lesson for us today in them.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, sure. I'm wondering what broadly, and you can take a minute to develop it if you'd like. This need not be a soundbite answer. What broadly is the carry-home message of Tales of Adam? What is the, you know, if Adam and Abel were sitting in this room with us today, what would they be telling us or warning us about?
The web endlessly woven in the hands of the god. The how life on Earth is a web endlessly woven, and how we are all connected to each other, and that the human path is no greater, more important than the path of a snail or a deer. This is what they would be trying to convey, contrary to our idea, to our own vision of ourselves as the preeminent creature on this earth, the one that God looks at and ignoring the rest.
So the theme, it seems, certainly in Ishmael, in your early work, which has become a cult book all around the world. I mean, you have such a following. Ishmael.org is the website for that, is it not?
Yes.
Yeah. Has been that somehow we think that we're separate from the rest of the world, and we think so at our peril.
Yes.
Is that a good summary?
Very much at our peril.
And how so?
We cannot exist without the rest of the living community. We are absolutely dependent on it for our lives. And so as we as biologists know now, we are in a period of mass extinction, meaning that the rate of extinction is roughly 1,000 times the normal background extinction.
This is extinctions of all other species.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's roughly estimated that we're about 200 species a day are becoming extinct because of our enormous impact on the world. And this is extremely dangerous. For one day, yes, that's okay. For 2 days, for a year, but to go on for like this year after year after year is ultimately going to bring about our own extinction.
And this is coming about because of a foundational story that we tell ourselves that we find even in our religious literature and histories.
Yes.
That story being?
That the world was made for us, but also that it's not really our home, that our home is to be found after death. This is merely a testing ground.
So in a way, our religions become cults of death?
Well, at least some of them do. Mm. Among the Buddhist point of view, the world is a place of suffering, and the goal is to become never to be reincarnated again, to escape rebirth.
To transcend that.
To disappear,
mm-hmm.
Whereas the animist point of view, my point of view, is that the world is our home, and we belong here, and we don't belong in heaven. This really is truly our home, but it's also the home of everything else that's living around us, and we're all interconnected and interdependent, and we are abusing that interdependence now by our attack on the diversity of the community.
Do you think that we need to change our worldview at the level of culture, at the level of religion, at the level of intellect, science? Where does this transformation happen that might prevent us from falling off the edge?
I would say at the level of culture, which, of course, cuts across all of these things,
at the level of culture, you think that this change has to happen?
Yes.
We have about a minute left.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Okay.
That was the cue that we just heard.
Oh, okay. It needs to cut across every category of our society. Eventually, reaching a tipping point. I bless the author of that book for giving us that insight about the tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
And we must hope to reach that tipping point where people see the world a different way than the way it's seen right now.
Yeah.
So that the electorate that put Bush back in office is going to keep on putting people like that in office so long as until that tipping point is reached.
Yeah, and that tipping point is us becoming awakened, becoming politically awakened. How do I say it? Beyond just politics, awakened to the toxicity of our culture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good. Well said. Daniel Quinn, thank you so much for being with us. His new book, Tales of Adam, it's in bookstores near you. You can find it online, ishmael.org. Information about Tales of Adam as well?
Oh, yes.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, tomhartmann.com, the website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, say hi, come on by. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger shows up to vote yesterday. This is from the Los Angeles Times, and is told that he's already voted. Sorry, the voting machine says you are already here, sir. And you have to wonder how many people in California had the same experience or similar experiences. It's incredible. Schwarzenegger's aides were informed of the problem when they arrived this morning to survey the governor's polling station. Poll worker said the governor's staff told the governor's staff he would have to use a provisional ballot that allows election workers to verify if two votes were made by the same person. The governor, however, was allowed to use a regular ballot. We can't have the governor being forced to use a provisional ballot. That would not look good. Well, Arnie blew it. He blew it. He spent millions, tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars of Californians' hard-earned tax dollars. Now, and increasingly, it's the sweatier brow hard-earned tax dollars, because corporations are paying less and less in taxes, and you and me are paying more and more in taxes. And he spent all his money to try and drive a wedge through the heart of Californians, and they just said, sorry, buddy, we're not taking it. We are not taking it. Cap spends, well, I need not go through the whole list of them. It's all over the news. You're getting it. I thought it was interesting. In Maine, it was sort of the opposite of Texas. And this is an interesting bookend. In Texas, there was a proposition and a ballot initiative that would have banned gay marriage. But interestingly, it was in two parts. The first part said that marriage is a union of a man and a woman. And the second part, what they were trying to say, essentially, was that, and by the way, we're not going to allow you to have civil unions either. It basically said the state doesn't have the power to establish any form of marriage. And the way it was worded, this is the problem with ballot initiatives. I mean, this is why you pay legislators to do their job. The way it was worded, apparently, there are some fairly knowledgeable attorneys around the country suggesting that Texas just voted to make marriage illegal in Texas. Because while Part A bans gay marriage, Part B, in attempting to ban civil unions, seems to ban marriage, period. And so now maybe everybody in Texas is no longer married who was married. So I suppose, you know, save a lot of money for those folks who were just waiting to get a divorce. Who knows? Remarkable. But the flip side of this is in Maine, there was a law passed by the Maine legislators that banned discrimination based on sexual orientation. And there was a ballot measure put on by the cons, you know, by the right-wingers, the bigots, I would say, to say, oh, no, sexual discrimination or discrimination based on sexual orientation, in other words, gay bashing and discriminate, you know, what, you're gay, you can't rent this apartment, that kind of thing. This should be legal in Maine. And so they wanted to repeal this law that included sexual orientation along with things like race and religion under the protection of the anti-discrimination laws in Maine. And so this ballot initiative was put on the ballot in Maine to repeal that law and go back to the bad old days, and the voters of Maine turned it down. Good on you. That's marvelous. Very, very well done. In New York, a plan to give the legislature, not the governor, the upper hand in writing the budget. That was rejected in Ohio. Interestingly, in Ohio, there was a plan to fix the voting machine problem and the whole problem of the Secretary of State being the guy who runs the show there, and that got shot down. Unfortunately, I think. Yeah, I don't live in Ohio. I'm not super up on this, but a lot of interesting voting laws. Things around the country approved in Ogunquit, Maine. A resolution that would ban chain restaurants, or a ballot initiative. In Philadelphia, approved imposed limits on campaign contributions by those seeking municipal contracts. Again, a good one, in my humble opinion. Approved opposing, this is in San Francisco, opposing military recruiting in public schools and colleges. Approved prohibit sale of guns and ammunition and ban residents except for police, security guards, and military personnel from possessing handguns. Appropriate in a city. May not be appropriate in a rural area, but appropriate in the city, I think. Rejected in Seattle, construction of a monorail. Bummer. Also, the ban on growing genetically modified crops in Sonoma County, Measure M, that was rejected. So, you win a few, you lose a few, but I'd say by and large, the message that voters were sending from across the United States yesterday in these elections, from coast to coast, was very straightforward. It was, hey, we've figured out what's going on. People are waking up, and they're saying, you're just not, gays, guns, and God just ain't going to do it anymore. We realize that there's an economic agenda here. There's a political agenda here. There's more here at stake than just whether or not we're going to let people burn the flag. There are real issues that are impacting real people, and we figured out that the cons, while they're trying to play this dance of, oh, we're actually, really very reasonable people, quack, 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 that the cons have an agenda that is ultimately, essentially, very anti-American. It's antithetical to the traditional values of America, and that's why these guys have to take these wedge issues and run on them, because if they said, hey, this is what we're really about, nobody would vote for them. And people are waking up to it because Bush has been pretty upfront about what he's all about. And they're saying, nah, we don't want that. We don't want it. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear.
You tell them, Jackson Brown.
You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. 440-THOM, our telephone number. And the Democrats winning big in New Jersey and Virginia. Schwarzenegger's initiatives bounced. An entire school board that was pushing intelligence design bounced out in one state. In another state, in Kansas, people voting for intelligent design. It's interesting, the kind of, speckling of this that's going on around the country. Julie in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Julie, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say I can channel Cassandra, and you had that Daniel Quinn on earlier, and that man speaks truth. He speaks it very slowly and with lots of pauses, but you got to get him back on. And yeah, Everyone who's out there listening to me right now, listen to that man. He's speaking truth.
I agree. And, in fact, I had him on my local program just before we did the segment on the national program.
I was listening.
Yeah. And I had said to Heidi Tauber, who does the program with me, I said, Heidi, if you read one book in your life, it has to be Ishmael.
Ishmael. It's on my bedside table always. I keep it there. Lives there.
Yeah, Dan Quinn is absolutely
brilliant. And I'm so excited to see the new book, and I really have got to say that man is speaking truth that we need to hear today.
Amen. Bye.
And so are you.
Okay, thanks, Julie.
And so am I.
There you go. Okay, great. Thanks. Great to hear from you. Thank you so much. David in, is it DuQuoin, Illinois?
It's DuQuoin.
DuQuoin. Okay, I'm sorry about that. What's
Hi,
up,
Tom.
David?
Well, you know, you discuss it every day. We've got several critical problems, many critical problems, that if we dealt with them all at once, we'd seem to be radicals because the direction in which we're going has to be changed 180 degrees, and to change that, it takes many different things to do it. And to do all those things at once would be seem like raving mad lunatics.
But there's a bigger picture, though, David, and that is that a lot of those things on both sides, frankly, on the conservative side and on the traditional American side, what they're portraying as the left but isn't. And, in fact, by the way, we're going to actually have somebody from the Communist Party of the United States on the program later this week to point out that what all these guys, you know, now we're going to have Hillary Clinton from the left, right? And it's like, give me a break. I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, this is, we're not the left, you know. You want
right,
the left.
I call that left-right paradigm the
it's nonsense.
Warfare distraction.
Yeah, it's nonsense. You want the left, we'll give you the real left, and we're going to hear from them later on this week. But in any case.
On the voting issue, Tom,
yeah.
The only solution to this is to make the vote auditable by the person who cast the vote. This is the only solution. Any other proposal that doesn't go to that link.
Well, you know, I don't disagree with you, David, but the problem with that is that I cast a vote. I can look and see whether that vote was cast appropriately, whether that ballot that is printed out is appropriately printed. But now that vote is going to be collected by a machine at the precinct level, and then it's going to be sent to a central tabulator at the.
Tom, the auditability, and you've written on this a lot, and I've read what you've written. The auditability needs to be done at the level where the vote, the public vote, is posted to the public, not at the when the person leaves the polling place. Yes, those who are courageous enough to request an itemized ballot. Copy of that should be able to do so that they can go back to their house and they can either get on the internet or they can walk down to the courthouse and they can request to see the table of public votes and then they can cross-reference their random.
See, I think there's the much, much simpler way, David, and thank you for making your point. You make it very well. The much simpler way, I think, is for us to simply go back to paper. As every other country in the world does. We are the only country in the world that's using electronic voting machines. Let me repeat that. We're the only country in the world that's using electronic voting machines. And you've got some very complex ballots, instant runoff voting in Australia and New Zealand. We're the only country in the world. And that is using, privatized electronic voting machines. And it's crazy. We should go back to paper ballots. Canada, they experimented with our voting machines, a couple of the provinces. Few years ago, three, four years ago, and then said, no, we don't want these things, and gave them back. Said, here, have them back. We're going to go back to paper. I think we should just go back to paper, frankly, and have, civil servants count the ballots, observed by, in the open, like they were counting the Chads down in Florida, observed by people representing the political parties, so that, there's no question. I found this very interesting in Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, rather, in St. Paul, Minnesota. Randy Kelly, the mayor, thought he would perform a brilliant political stunt and came out and endorsed Bush. He was the first, he is now, a day after the election, the first incumbent mayor in over 30 years to lose. And he's lost by 30% to 70%. I wiped him out. So much for endorsing George W. Bush if you're a political candidate. Walter in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Walter, not up there. There we go. Hey, Walter, what's up?
How's it going, Tom? I just heard you mention the wedge issues, and I was wondering why, if the wedge issues are unimportant, why is it that your side will not prove it by abandoning them?
My side?
Yes, sir.
Which side is that?
The left.
I'm sorry. I'm not in favor of the government owning all of our businesses.
Okay,
that's the left. The left is the Communist Party and the socialists, and I'm not a communist or a socialist.
Okay, perhaps I have mislabeled you, but what?
Right, I'm an average American.
What caught my attention was your support of San Francisco's ban on ammunition, and you labeled that as one of the wedge issues. If that issue is unimportant, why is it that the people who support it won't abandon it? Why won't you prove that it's an unimportant issue and abandon it to get on to the other issues that are more important, like the economy?
Do you think that I support gun control and bans on guns?
You just said that the San Francisco ban on ammunition was a good thing.
I said I thought it might be a good thing in an urban area. I don't think it would be in a rural area. When I lived in Vermont, you know, Bernie Sanders, who is I think he's a great guy, very progressive, does not support gun control. Vermont's a very rural state. Most people have guns. A lot of people hunt. And they have a very, very low murder rate. On the other hand, you know, I've spent a lot of time in New York City, enough to virtually say I've lived there. And I think in a city like New York City, having control over weapons, having some sort of ban on the ownership of weapons, at least to the extent that you could say we have a ban on the ability to drive a car. Right. In other words, you have to demonstrate your competence and you have to be on record in order to drive a car. Now, if you want to call that a ban on car driving, that's fine. But in that same context, I think that having a ban on the ownership of ordnance in some urban areas is appropriate. But I also think that each urban area should make that decision for themselves. So I'm not a person who thinks that I'm not an absolutist in either direction on the gun control issue.
Okay, I understand.
And I hope I'm making sense. I think that this is actually a reasonable position. I'm not, you know, there's no ideology here. I'm trying to be practical about it.
Well, if you look at the things that make Vermont a different place, for example, Vermont doesn't have the same amount of drug problems that, say, New York or California does.
Actually, on a per capita basis, it's worse.
It depends on the type of drug we're talking about.
I'm talking about heroin.
Drug usage, perhaps, but drug wars over territory by drug dealers is different. That's why there's a lower murder rate in that place.
Could be. And frankly, I think if the drug wars are what's causing the murder rate, you can solve that problem like Colin did and like Great Britain did by simply decriminalizing the use of those drugs and throwing them into the medical arena rather than the criminal arena.
You'll get no argument from me on that.
Yeah, and you know, instantly. I mean, if England saw over a 30% drop in petty crime and assaults when they made heroin a prescription drug and said, hey, instead of dealing with the cops on this, we're going to deal with a doctor. So, you know, but that's not a gun issue. I mean, you know, it's...
That is not. That is a crime issue, but whenever guns are treated as a crime issue, it forces people to... It galvanizes people. It forces us to take a stand, either for or against the law.
Yeah, and well, as I said, I think that should be done on a local basis by local people who are making the decision based on, you know, what they think is best for their communities, and that's where I stand on. Walter, I thank you for your call and for your thoughtful perspective. Bob in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Great. We got about a minute left before we got to take a break. What's up?
The election comments that you guys were making.
Yes, sir.
There's only really one run-through cure 24 hours a day on Saturday. We're a 24-hour-a-day society now, and it's going to have to be done on a Saturday.
Oh, you mean to be able to vote?
So everybody can vote.
Right. You know, I don't disagree with you, and I found it really interesting that there was a poll that was done. I think it might have been a Roper poll. I'm not sure who did it, but it was in the last week, and it was, you know, a reputable polling organization, and they found that only 30% more or less, might have been 31, 32%, something like that, about a third of Americans support changing the day we vote from Tuesdays.
Oh,
go
really?
Figure. Yeah, go figure. I think really what it is that there's an underlying sentiment that Americans are basically saying, let's, you know, we're feeling insecure about voting. We're a little concerned that everything is being messed with. You know, let's not make any radical changes. But I agree with you. I think that if the day for voting,
you know, we're only opening up the polls 50% of the time.
I know.
Only 25% of the people vote.
I agree, and a lot of people can't get off from work. And frankly, I don't think it should just be Saturday. Why not make it all day Saturday, all day Sunday? I mean, you know, it'd be very simple that way, and people could get out and they could vote anytime they wanted. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends.
Well, it's a strange old game to learn slow. One step forward and it's back to go.
There you go. 9 minutes before the hour. 9.5 minutes before the hour, if you want to get super technical about it. Yeah, the oil executives testified in Washington, D.C. today. It's getting kind of weird. You'll recall when the baseball players were called before Congress to testify at the steroid hearings, they were asked to swear that their truth would be the truth, their testimony would be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. In other words, they were put under oath. Now, this is not just about thinking that God's going to get you if you lie. There's also a legal consequence to this. If you lie under oath, the penalties are dramatically different. Well, in the case of Bill Clinton, lying under oath got him impeached from office. He was not removed by the Senate, but he was impeached by the House of Representatives. Got him indicted, essentially, for lying under oath. So lying under oath, not a small thing, although the cons would like you to have you think it is. And in fact, you know, we had the tobacco industry executives standing up, and they were asked to speak under oath.
Please consider yourself to be under oath.
Yes or no? Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes.
Congressman, cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction.
I don't believe that nicotine or our products are addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
And I, too, believe that nicotine is not addictive.
There you have the heads of the largest tobacco companies in the country, and you'll recall it started out... it started out...
Please consider yourself to be under oath.
There you go. So today... You've got, and of course, Jack Abramoff, when he testified before Congress, he was put under oath. So now we have the oil industry executives coming before Congress, and they're being asked some questions about their profits, their rather unseemly profits, billions of dollars a month, the largest profits in the history of the planet, in the history of civilization, in the history of all human beings accumulating all wealth. The oil companies are doing better than it has ever been done before. And even Republicans want to know why. But the Democrats said, shouldn't these guys be put under oath so that we know that if they tell us something that it's true? Because if they're not under oath, I mean, you know, penalties are a little different. The Republicans, no, we're not going to put them under oath. We're not going to do it. I kid you not, the Republicans refused to put the oil industry executives under oath when they testified before the Senate. So when you see that Senate testimony on TV, just know what's going on. Now, these guys, they did not have to say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. No, they didn't. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to ask you about torture. I was trying to figure out why these people were using it, and it seemed like I came up with a few reasons. One is that it seems like it's a form of domestic intimidation as well. It's a way of intimidating the American people and saying, don't mess with the government. And I also think it might be a kind of perversion in their own minds, a form of like just drunkenness with power, where they enjoy kind of the idea that they can do this and have no consequences.
Well, there's this bizarre notion, that a mentality that thinks that the threat of violence is the best way to do things. And, you know, the fact of the matter is the threat of violence or the threat of force will produce instant results. It's just like a lightning bolt will produce instant results, but it may not produce the results you want.
Well, it also seems to be a tactic employed when you want to do things on the cheap. It seems like something that you would do if you didn't have enough men, for example.
Yeah, it could be. I think, though, that what you're seeing here is the psychopathology of the Bush administration, the mental illness of some of the folks within this administration, and many of their followers, who themselves may have been abused kids. I mean, who knows? Being applied to the country, being writ large. We spent the last 50 years saying, wait a minute, you know, looking at the horrors of World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust and the horrors of what the Nazis did and what the Japanese did during World War II, for which, by the way, today, citizens of those countries are still apologizing saying, we're better than that.
But if we let this exemption go through, I don't understand why people aren't pointing out that this exemption will apply to American citizens as well.
Yeah. In other words, you too could be tortured by the CIA.
Exactly.
Yeah. And well, that's where it gets weird, because I think most Americans just can't imagine that of themselves. It's the same thing with all these other police power laws that have been given to government, where, you know, it's let's give government just a little more power. Let's give them a little more power, a little more invasive, a little more intrusive. And then you discover that, hey, wait a minute, I'm the one whose phone they've been tapping. I was talking with Peter DeFazio this morning, the congressman from Oregon. He said now 30,000 sweeps, nets thrown, where hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands of records of individual Americans, including where they shopped, what they bought, what websites they looked at, what their emails said, who they called, their phone records, their phone logs, what they were watching on cable TV, where all this information has been swept up under the Patriot Act by this administration. And the administration says that they have the right to even provide this information to commercial corporations.
Well, it's just funny that torture is finally driving a wedge between the Republicans, and they're imploding now because of it. And I think it's just it's the last straw.
Well,
I guess
it's emblematic of the mentality. Logan, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, it's emblematic of the mindset of these guys and the tragically mindless mindset. I mean, if you want to be effective at getting information out of people, you know, they say, well, what do you do if you've got a bomb that's going to go off in 1 hour? If somebody put a bomb that's going to go off in 1 hour, if they got to the point in a terrorist organization where they could do that, they'll put up with an hour of torture, or they'll give you the wrong information. I mean, this is we know from years and years and years looking back, torture is not the way to get the best information. The way to get the best information is to flip people. And besides that, you're establishing the precedent of we are a brutal society. So what happens when American soldiers, or American citizens for that matter, what happens if you're traveling overseas and some other country's security service snatches you and wants to know, we can torture you. After all, Americans do it. Why can't we? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the United States of America, the place where smart people get their news. Alec Dubrow is with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. And hey, Alec.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope you are the same.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
The gloom has lifted a little bit.
There you go. A big win for labor in California yesterday.
A big win on the several labor-connected initiatives that Schwarzenegger was pushing. They were defeated. And there was a court ruling in our favor on worker time. Recently, where company maintained that workers had to change into their protective gear on their own time. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that this was not so. National Association of Manufacturers is wailing and weeping and saying this is going to throw businesses into bankruptcy, but I have my doubts on that one.
Yeah. They've been saying, you know, gee, if we have to pay a living wage, it'll throw businesses into bankruptcy. If we have to pay a union wage, it'll throw businesses. And surprisingly, you know, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, when we were doing pretty good and a lot of people were earning a good union wage, businesses weren't going bankrupt. They were doing great because a lot of consumers were getting a decent wage and they were using that money to go out there and buy products that were being made by business.
Somehow we've gotten away from that formula, and
yeah.
I'm hoping enough people are waking up to this fact. Certainly, we keep telling them. Nevertheless, the fact of the matter is, people who want to organize, in order to improve their position in the workplace, not just wages but dignity, are at such a disadvantage in this country that it's appalling.
Give me a 15-second history of the National Labor Relations Board, and then bring us up to date on where it's at these days.
Well, it's very interesting that the board came about in, approximately 1935 when the act was voted in.
This was not the Wagner Act. This was associated with it, or was this the Wagner Act?
Now you're confusing me. They both were implemented at roughly the same time.
Okay, so this is the National Labor Relations Act, wasn't it?
National Labor Relations Act created a board. And they said in it, in the preamble to it, experience has proved that protection by law, the right to organize, safeguards commerce from injury, impairment, or interruption, promotes the flow of commerce by removing certain recognized sources of industrial strife. So that they felt that having organized workers was a benefit both to commerce and to the workers themselves.
Right, because workers, prior to having union protections, workers would engage in wildcat strikes. You had sabotage. And on the other side, you had corporations hiring private armies and mercenaries to, in some cases, murder workers. And, going all the way back to Joe Hill, and it was a mess. And so the government said, fine, okay, we're going to level a playing field and equal power to the company and to the workers and let them negotiate and work things out.
But in recent years, I was just talking to an attorney here saying that consistently the National Labor Relations Board, which is now headed by two Republicans, one Democrat, they are shrinking the kinds of workers who are protected by the act. They're shrinking who can bargain collectively, and they've been shrinking remedies. So to such an extent that the courts now are beginning to overturn some of these rulings.
So the National Labor Relations, let me just get this straight, Alec. You're saying that the National Labor Relations Board, which was created specifically by an act of Congress in 1935 to defend the interests of labor and promote organized labor in the workplace, has, since the Republicans took over and stacked at 2 to 1 Republicans to Democrats, has been consistently working against the interests of organized labor and against the interests of workers?
I think if you tote up the rulings, that's exactly what you'll find.
And it's gotten so bad that the court system, which is now more than half of all federal judges have been appointed by either Reagan, Bush, or Bush, court systems are even saying, you guys are outrageous, you're going too far?
Yeah. I mean, in one recent ruling, the Seventh Circuit ruled against the National Labor Relations Board because they had sided with a company who said that they were perfectly justified in locking out any union members. And the court said in the end, to uphold this would be to destroy four decades of employee protection. So even some conservatives here are beginning to get very uneasy with what to me seems like a formula for class warfare on the shop floor.
Yeah.
We don't know how this is going to play out. The board still, most of their rulings are at the local level. They don't reach the level of the courts. They're never appealed. Most of them sort of die in committee in the sense that these things get dragged out so long that many of the workers who initiated are gone by the time there's a ruling.
Now, are the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, members? You said it's a 2 to 3. There are three members, and two of them are Republicans, one are Democrat. They're appointed by the president?
They are appointed by the president. It's the same kind of process as it is for judges. Yes, they are. At the moment, it's sort of a standoff. The full board is five members, but because of who is likely to be nominated, Democrats in Congress are not too keen on approving them, and
so
the president hasn't even bothered to appoint anybody.
So they have to be confirmed by the Senate, in other words, just like judges.
Yes, that's right.
And the president hasn't even bothered to send up any names.
No. These are not important things to the president because he has his focus in other areas.
Yeah, he wants to be sure he can torture people.
Yep.
Well, that's a whole other discussion. So anyway, back to the labor movement.
Yes. So one remedy that the labor movement is choosing, if we have enough time to mention, is on December 10th, events around December 10th, which is International Human Rights Day. We signed on to the International Human Declaration of Human Rights, which states, quote, everyone has the right to form and join trade unions for the protection of his interests. Let's make that his or her interests. But in any case, we've signed on to it and disregarded it to such an extent that the labor movement is trying to at least raise the issue and to shame the government into at least facing the fact that they have been in complete disregard of this.
When you say we signed on to it, you're not talking about the AFL-CIO. You're talking about the United States government signed on to it.
That is correct. That is correct.
So the United States government signed this international treaty that said we respect the right of people to join unions to protect themselves, you know, et cetera. And this is not being done by this administration. And so on December 10th, I noticed that there's a rally in downtown Seattle. These are all over the country, though, right?
They're all over the country. And if people want to find out about it, go to the AFL-CIO website. It's www.aflcio.org/D, as in December 10, D10.
D10.
That's right, for okay. December 10th. And they're getting international support for this from labor leaders around the world. The most, the only famous name, but at the moment is Lech Walesa, who has signed on, asking the U.S. government to essentially reinstate the right to organize and to bargain collectively.
That's amazing when you've got the president, or former president now, of a former Soviet state asking the United States to please be more democratic.
Yeah. We're not perfect.
Well, it should dawn on people
at this point, yes.
It's a sad commentary on where this administration is taking this nation. It's just a tragic commentary.
It is. You know, as you pointed out before, democracy, it seems to end at the workplace door.
And so what is this Voice at Work campaign, Alec Dubrow?
Well, that's a institute of the AFL-CIO, which is raising awareness of people's essential right under the international treaties and right in essence of the U.S. government.
So this
that people have a right to a voice at work. That is, they should not be intimidated, should not be fired, should not be punished in any way for speaking up on workplace issues.
And the website for this is also flcio.org/D10.
AFLCIO.org/D10.
Capital D or lowercase d? Because after the slash,
lowercase d.
Okay, lowercase d.
In any case, if you go to just the AFLCIO, it's there and you can click onto it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and I will mention this again before December 10th comes up. But
okay.
We're making a point here.
Yeah, and congratulations to everybody in the organized labor movement. I was going to say congratulations to you, to us. I'm a union member myself for the victory in California yesterday. Well done.
Let's keep it moving.
There you go. Alec Dubrow, he's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, www.ilcaonline.org. Alec, thanks a lot for being with us today.
You take care, Tom.
We'll talk to you again soon. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or smalldog.com, where you can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, the website, tomhartman.com, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, and the most interesting thing that happened today were the energy hearings up at the Senate, chaired by Senator Stevens of Alaska. Senator Boxer, Barbara Boxer, brought out a chart with the executive bonuses for the oil companies, and then she asked them if they're willing to give a part of their bonus for public relief. Well, Stevens reprimanded her for the chart, and then they got into an open argument between the two of them. Then later, the people cheered in the hearing room, which you're not allowed to do at a Senate hearing, when Senator Wyden of your lovely Oregon demanded that the CEOs give up their tax incentive for public assistance. This is, of course, the oil company's tax incentive.
Are you going to have the audio of that, by the way, on your Talk Radio News website? Because I'd love to
have it later today.
I would love to have Ron Wyden's that clip of Ron Wyden for our local show tomorrow.
We will try and do that for you. And Senator Stevens then threatened to totally clear the hearing.
Now, in the meantime, I understand that the Democrats wanted these oil industry executives to be put under oath, and the Republicans refused
That's
to do it.
That's exactly correct. The Republicans said they already took an oath.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, you know, you wonder then why you have a situation like in St. Paul, Minnesota. Randy Kelly was a Democrat. He endorsed President Bush in 2004. He was defeated by Chris Coleman, another Democrat, 69-31%. Hello?
Right. He thought endorsing Bush would be good for his campaign. Yeah.
As I always say, Senator Norm Coleman, who used to be a Democrat, looked in the mirror, thought he saw the next president of the United States, and decided to go for whoever right-wing thing that he could get.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that in 2 years, 3 years down the road, Al Franken is going to knock him off his perch, but we'll see, you know.
I actually think he will as well, and I said that to Norm Coleman. I said, you better watch out. Yeah, your votes are too right-wing.
Yeah.
He laughs at me.
Yeah, well.
Now, today, just as soon as I finish with you, I'm going to go to the American Enterprise Institute to go to the Shalabi event, and it promises to be quite a few protests out there, so that should be very, very interesting.
Oh, interesting, yeah. Let me ask you, to my listeners, please forgive the inside baseball talk here, but just to ask you a favor. We used to, a year or two ago, from time to time, actually with some regularity, be able to get guests from the Heritage Foundation. They would send, because I try to have conservatives on this program, and I don't abuse people. Your good friend Dick Morris hung up on me, as you know, but
right.
I mean, that's the exception, not the rule, and I'm generally quite polite to them. Give them a chance to have their say. I'll argue with them, but, you know, I'm not going to call them names.
Well, my friend runs press for there, so maybe when you come to town next time, I can sit you guys down for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, well, I used to know Chris Kennedy there, you know, and he used to feed us folks, and he was just, you know, feed them to lions. But in any case, he used to send us folks all the time, and we could put him on the air. And he left, and there's somebody new, and they're like, sorry, we're not gonna send people out to put him on liberal talk radio shows. So if you could put in a good word for us, I'd appreciate it.
We'll do so. It's always best if I can get people to meet face to face. And when people meet you, Tom, they know what a nice guy you are, and then they behave themselves.
Well, bless you, Ellen. Thank you. By the way, how is your eye?
My eye is it's in recovery, slowly but surely. And
good.
Again, if you see any little things in your eye that are particularly black, go to a doctor. Don't waste any time. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Yeah. And finally, other news in Washington, D.C. today.
Well, the other interesting news is that, as you know, there's a lot of talk right now about whether they should open up the federal courts to cameras, and there is a hearing going on about that as we speak. That is a very big issue, and, you know, of course, some of us think that that's a great idea, but then you do get people sometimes who do play to the cameras, as we know, and trials
sure.
can become a lot longer.
Sure, and we've certainly seen that with, you know, very high profile trials. O.J. Simpson, for example, that trial turned essentially into a circus.
That's right.
So, how do you think that? We have just a minute left, Ellen. How do you think this thing is going to play out with the oil industry executives? Seems
well,
to me that this is just is going to be.
I realize that they have an issue that the Republicans are not responding to in a way that the American populace wants, and they're going.
But it was Republicans who called for the hearings, wasn't it?
Well, they did, but they're not expecting. I mean, they're asking for all these voluntary things. And you have real pushback on this issue. And I think that the Democrats, if they're smart about it, can turn this into a huge election issue. And the Republicans, you would think that they would jump on this. But
yeah, you would think so. I think
when you're in power, it does strange things to you.
Yeah, well, and they call these hearings, and then they screw up the hearings by saying, well, we're not going to put them under oath. And no, Barbara Boxer, you can't pull out these charts. And it just seems to me like you know, the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Right.
The Republican Party, and they've always been so disciplined, but once they actually start revealing their true stripes, boy, it's like run for cover.
You got
it's
it.
It's amazing. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks a lot, Ellen. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good one. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour. The place where we run rings around the right wing every single day. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the top of the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. For your minimum a daily adult requirement of sanity, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Yes, time for a conservative alert. A recent ABC News poll found that 70% of Americans consider the charges against Scooter Libby to be serious, 60% think Karl Rove should resign, and a majority, more than half of Americans, believe that the Libby indictment, quote, indicates broader problems with ethical wrongdoing in the Bush administration, end quote. In other words, America is concerned that we have a major felon committing major felonies in the White House. So, what do we hear from Weekly Standard contributors Fred Bill Kristol and Fred Barnes in recent weeks? This is a transcript from, I believe this is Fox News. I may be wrong. I don't have the reference here, but I believe it is. John Scott. Fred, I guess I don't get the sense that Americans, you know, across this great country are outraged about the Valerie Plame incident. Fred Barnes. And this is a pretty minor scandal, I believe, when it involves the chief of staff of the vice president, merely a perjury charge and false statements. He says that this is a scandal that elites across America and people who are really interested in politics in Washington are aware of, but most people don't care about, nor should they. Yeah. But if the president has sex with an intern, oh boy, you better tell him about it. You better yell about it. You better impeach that guy. Ravi in Espanola, New Mexico on the line. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-TOM, T-H-O-M. Hey, Ravi.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Yeah, me too.
Great.
I'm really wondering what's going on here. I was on the Bev Harris site, and she had the GAO release.
The Government Accountability Office, the new report saying that the voting machines are not secure and they're not safe.
Yeah, the cover on it's federal efforts to improve security and reliability of electronic voting systems are underway, but key activities need to be completed.
Right.
Quite a title.
Yeah.
I have found virtually nothing on this on the American press.
Nothing. There's been nothing. I mean, when this thing came out, we talked about it on this program. We had Bev on this program, in fact, talking about this. We had Andrew Gumbel on from The Independent in the UK, a number of people. But as far as I know, I'm not even sure that a lot of other progressive programs were covering it, frankly. I think that there's a lot of people who are afraid that if they talk about electronic voting machines, people are going to think there's some kind of conspiracy nut. And, you know, I just don't see this as conspiracy nut territory. I'm sorry. I see this as a real problem for democracy territory. And it concerns me that the American press broadly, and even you know, progressive press is by and large not paying attention to it. I know Randy Rhodes talks about it on her program, God bless her, but I don't hear it much anywhere else.
Well, I've got two kind of comments on it. I'd really like to have Bev talk about just that one particular thing that she went to, the threat to voting systems, sponsored by the National Institutes of Standards and Technology.
Right.
That would be an interesting subject. And also on the conspiracy theory. Now, the Republicans did a really good kind of frontal assault on that.
Mm-hmm.
They made it so anybody that says conspiracy theory is suspect immediately.
Right.
You know, they front-loaded this and made it so you can't talk about conspiracy theories. Because,
right.
Guess what? There is one.
Or there doesn't have to be one. I mean, if you've got a, like, if you and I, Ravi, were to discover tomorrow that every bank in America's ATM could be easily hacked by simply typing in the number five times, and all of a sudden the ATM would spit out $20 bills at you, it wouldn't require a conspiracy for people all over America to start hacking ATMs.
It would
simply require the knowledge. And I mean, if Howard Dean can hack a Diebold machine on national TV and teach us all how to do it in the process, there may or may not be a conspiracy, but the fact of the matter is that these things can be hacked. And that should be giving a lot of people pause. And yeah, I agree with you. And that's what the GAO report is about. And we'll talk to Bev about getting her back on the program again. Ravi, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Tom. I recorded the first half hour of your program in which I assume you interviewed Daniel Quinn.
Yeah, the first 15 minutes, yeah.
Oh, good. I'll look forward to listening
Dan's one of those very thoughtful guys who takes a little bit of time to gather his thoughts, but when he says something, it's usually something pretty important.
Profound.
If you've read his book, you know what I'm talking about. His books.
Well, I read My Ishmael with my then 11-year-old, and I just started reading The Story of Bea this past week.
Mm-hmm.
So, before I ask you about the policy of the administration toward the rest of the Americans, I have to ask what your favorite fiction book by Quinn is.
My favorite is Ishmael.
Okay.
Or My Ishmael. I think
I love My Ishmael. So
yeah, much. I think that his first book or his first two books were really the strongest. I wrote a blurb for Beyond Civilization. You'll find my name at the top of the back cover of mm-hmm. Beyond Civilization. Dan's Quinn's book, and he wrote a blurb for my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which was very sweet of him. This is the first time we've actually met, though. He was in the studio here with us, which was nice. It was really meeting him and Rennie, his wife. So.
Well, on to...
But that's not what you called about, is it?
Yes. Do you think this rogue administration will really go through with its plans to stop the succession of Fidel Castro's brother whenever Fidel dies, and how do you think the rest of Latin America will respond, particularly Chavez and Venezuela? And what plans do the neocons have for those countries?
It's hard to say, Bonnie, and I've got to tell you, I'm pretty ambivalent about it as well. Raul Castro, from everything that I've been able to learn, and I have spent a fair amount of time digging into this, we have this week now just released a book about the Kennedy years and the plan that Robert Kennedy had to assassinate Fidel Castro back in 1963. It's called Ultimate Sacrifice, and it just literally is hitting bookstores next week that Lamar Waldron and I wrote, and how this all, you know, plays in with the Kennedy assassination. And my take on Raul Castro is that the guy is a madman, that he's not anybody that I would want running my country, frankly. And Cuba is, I mean, let's face facts, you speak out against the government in Cuba, you end up in prison. And that is not the kind
right.
of country that we would want to be living in. So the extent to which the United States interferes in Cuban policies and politics, if the extent to which we're interfering is like the way that we did it in the Ukraine, for example, where we're supporting a democracy movement and supporting exit polls and, you know, just the whole thing of democracy, I'm frankly in favor of it. On the other hand, if we're talking about some ham-handed, you know, military thing or, you know, CIA hits or stuff like that, that stuff backfires more often than it succeeds. And just from a practical point of view, much less the whole moral issue, from a practical point of view, I think it's crazy. Whether you know how this is going to be handled by South America, I don't know. How Chavez is going to react to the death of Castro when it ultimately happens, or if Chavez is even going to be in power, I don't know. I mean, you know, Castro might surprise us. He might live another 10 years. He might be gone tomorrow. I just don't know.
Well, I just see it as an opportunity to boost the poor favorability ratings of this regime, and what do you think?
In other words, by getting into another war?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And these people are demonized so much, and rightly or wrongly so. You know, I'm sure there are good reasons for demonization. I mean, I know Castro is a dictator. I know that. Okay, but, you know, I just think it would be another opportunity to raise the favorability rate and then also to demolish our civil and human rights and just breaking the deficit even more. And how will our creditor respond?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out, Bonnie. As I said, I just don't know. I think that you're spot on, though, and I appreciate your call. I think that you're just absolutely spot on to be raising this issue, because here's in my mind how the scenario is going to play out. Bush has signaled to us and to the world on many occasions, as has Condi Rice, that they're prepared to declare war against Syria, and they're going to use any excuse they can find. They're vilifying, perhaps rightly so, Bashir for al-Assad for the participation in the assassination of the Lebanese politician, prime minister. They're talking about, but now the big thing that they're trying, you know, we just blew up a building on the Syrian border. We said that it had weapons in it. We're attacking a city on the Syrian border. It's like when we were in Vietnam going into Laos and Cambodia, you know, it's that kind of pushing up against the edge thing. And frankly, I think that Bush wants to have another war, a what he hopes will be a popular war for the 2006 elections. And he'll probably try to have that as a relatively short, successful war rather than a long, drawn-out war. And he'll probably try to have it, my guess would be, in August, September, October of 2006. And so we're seeing the ginning up to it already. But if the Middle East is so blowing up in his face, so backfiring at him, that he decides not to do that, I think, you know, he may try what Reagan did, which is going for a cheap, easy, simple war in this hemisphere. You know, Reagan went after Grenada, and when he had a scandal going on, hey, let's take out Grenada. It flips the news cycle. It makes you seem like a big hero. Bush was carefully watching when Margaret Thatcher, you know, when the troops came home from Argentina from the Falklands Islands, and Margaret Thatcher was just, you know, elevated to goddess status in the UK. It was the height of her power because of the successful short war, which is what I think he thought he was going to have in Iraq. And so, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he tried something in this hemisphere. The problem is there's not a lot of Grenadas left. You know, that's the problem that he has. And, you know, Haiti, Cuba, Venezuela, if he tries to step his foot into one of those countries, he's going to be getting into something not that different from Iraq. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Well, he started into dealing with slaves and something inside of him died. She had to sell everything she owned and froze up inside. And when it all came crashing down, I became withdrawn. The only thing I knew how to do was keep on keeping on like a bird that flew, kind of like in blue.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, we just got to keep on keeping on. 9 minutes before the hour. Over at thinkprogress.org, boy, do they have it nailed. From a year ago in the Washington Post, a year ago, September 30th, 2004, this is a quote, the Washington Post, the Bush administration battling negative perceptions of the Iraq war is sending Iraqi Americans to deliver what the Pentagon calls good news about Iraq to U.S. military bases and has curtailed distribution of reports showing increasing violence in that country. The unusual public relations effort by the Pentagon and the U.S. Agency for International Development comes as details have emerged showing the U.S. government and a representative of President Bush's reelection campaign had been heavily involved in drafting a speech given to Congress last week by interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Okay, so here we have a year ago, the Washington Post talking about the unusual public relations effort by the Pentagon and USAID. Yesterday, CNN. Was it yesterday? Let's see. What is today's date? Yesterday, 11/8. Top White House officials say they're developing a, quote, campaign-style strategy, end quote, in response to increasing Democratic allegations that the Bush administration twisted intelligence to make its case for war. White House aides who agreed to speak to CNN only on the condition of anonymity said they hope to increase what they called their hit back in coming days. Incredible. They're going to try and win the war on talking points because they've got nothing real. This is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. a brewing controversy, this also from Think Progress, brewing controversy about exactly what was said at the White House press conference on October 31st. Scotty McClellan, well, the question that was asked by NBC's David Gregory, whether there's a question of legality, we know for a fact that there was involvement. We know that Karl Rove, based on what he and his lawyer have said, did have a conversation about somebody who Patrick Fitzgerald said was a covert officer of the CIA. We know that Scooter Libby also had conversations. Congressional Quarterly and FNS both transcribed Press Secretary Scotty McClellan's answer as, that's accurate. That's accurate. But the White House transcript, the transcript in the White House says, has Scotty saying, I don't think that's accurate. You get this? I don't think that's accurate? I mean, pretty amazing.
Whether there's a question of legality, we know for a fact.
Yeah, it seems like it's hiccuping here. Yeah, I thought I could play the clip. Apparently, I can't. But I was going to play it for you. You can see, you know, this is Scotty McClellan. So the White House is revising history here on their website. This is incredible. They can just get away with this. You know, just absolutely amazing. So anyway, we'll come back to that a little later on. A nationwide victory for progressives. Yesterday, election day, for many Americans, progressives won big, won huge, actually, I would say. This is a big deal, a very big deal. And won, you know, the elections, Arnold, the pushback against Arnold, the elections of Democrats in New Jersey. Let's just go right through this thing. All right, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger crossed the board defeats. California voters rejected every single measure he put up. And I would add, he showed up to vote, and the voting machine said that he had already voted and kicked him out, or tried to kick him out. Actually, they said, oh, we'll fix this here. In Maine, for the first time, Maine voters, this is from the Progress Report, Center for American Progress, for the first time, Maine voters approved a set of civil rights protections for gays and lesbians, voting down a conservative-backed measure that would have overturned a ban on discrimination in housing, employment, and education based on sexual orientation. They had succeeded in both 2000 and 1998 in overturning laws that protected gays from discrimination in housing, employment, and education based on sexual orientation. They did not succeed this time. Although the Kansas Board of Education voted yesterday to back intelligent design in Dover, Pennsylvania. The incumbent school board members had been pushing their anti-science intelligent design campaign, and there were people who campaigned against them on the pro-science Dover Cares campaign in Dover, Pennsylvania, and eight out of eight of these people who were saying, let's get rid of evolution, and let's teach intelligent design, let's go back to creationism, 8 out of 8 of them lost. In Dover, Pennsylvania. So some serious pushback there. The New York Times pointing out the obvious. How can you say it beyond pointing out the obvious? The New York Times, George Bush's political capital turned into a deficit. The AP's Ron Fournier agreed, referring to Bush as a political toxin, noting that the president put his wispy political prestige on the line when the Virginia candidate he embraced in a last-minute campaign stop was soundly defeated. And then, of course, the mayoral race in Minnesota's capital, St. Paul. St. Paul voters punished Mayor Randy Kelly on Tuesday. This was a Democrat, of all things, for standing with President Bush a year ago, denying the Democrat a second term in Minnesota's capital city. He was beat by another Democrat who would not stand with George W. Bush. By 2-1, the other guy beat him. It was a 70-30, more or less. So pretty amazing. However, on the dark side, as it were, in Texas, the voters approved a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. So here we are, guns, gays, and gods again. Or God. Go back to Daniel Quinn, who can make a plural. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason and passion go together. Sort of like Republican presidents and gay hookers and White House press passes. Yeah.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from coast to coast on radio stations all over America. The measure of a country's greatness, said Mahatma Gandhi, should be based on how well it cares for its most vulnerable populations. And this was, you know, one of the essential messages of Judaism, of Christianity, of Islam, of Buddhism, of Hinduism, of the world's great religions, of certainly of animism, of tribal religions, if you want to call them religions. This is an ancient notion. And yet we have people who proclaim their Christianity and then say, more tax cuts for the rich, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut, you know, et cetera. How Christian is that? And what are the parallels between what happened in Germany with the rise of the Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, and the American Christians today? Steve Martin is the president of Vital Visuals Incorporated, the website vitalvisuals.com. And Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, great. You have a new movie, a new video or a documentary, Theologians Under Hitler. And, in fact, if people go to your website, vitalvisuals.com and /tuh.htm and scroll down to the bottom, there's a pretty good-sized clip of it that you have on the web that people can watch. Tell us the story. How did so many seriously, drenched in the church theologians, I mean, I'm talking about people who had, you know, been through the whole nine yards and were preachers, get sucked into Nazism?
They were, the guys in our study here were not, they were just your average, your average folk. They were extremely intelligent, not really particularly ideologues in any political bent before the Nazi period, and really paradoxical in a lot of ways. Gerhard Kittel being one of the significant ones we study, who is the still today. I mean, he died in 1947, but his reference work is still the most used reference work on the Jewish background of the New Testament. That's used today. It's used widely in all in evangelical churches, evangelical seminaries, and he turned out to be the most harsh anti-Semite of the bunch there. How did they fall for it? That's a really good question. How do good people fall for all kinds of bad things?
So is this something intrinsic to human nature, the ability or the vulnerability? I mean, for example, there were a lot of Lutheran leaders. The Reichsbishop, Pastor Mueller, Bishop Mueller,
right.
I believe was Lutheran. And he committed suicide at the end of World War II, if I recall my history correctly. And yet, you know, Hitler had made him basically in charge of the Reichskirche, the German church, the Reichs, the church. And here was a guy coming out of the Lutheran faith and foundational to Martin Luther's thinking, you know, the guy who started Lutheranism, if that's the right word, was this idea of the two kingdoms, you know, which went back to Jesus saying, you know, somebody came to him and said, should I pay the taxes? He says, whose picture's on the coin? The guy says, Caesar. He says, render unto Caesar's what's Caesar's and to God's what's God's. Luther's idea that there's the secular world and there's the religious world and that they should never meet. That's the separation of church and state was something. And now this coming from the founder of the Protestant, the non-Church of England Protestant faith, saying there should be an absolute separation of church and state. And yet the Nazis saw a merger of the church and state, and the Lutherans were leading the way. How could they ignore their own foundations like this?
Well, everybody looked at the situation as a solution to the crisis. The crisis happened in the 1920s when German society just fell apart for a whole lot of different reasons. And the church wanted renewal. People in the church wanted renewal. The people in the government, in the civil sphere, wanted renewal. And And then you've got politicians involved in things, which we all know generally politicians are looking for constituency. They're looking for a way to bring in a large constituency to their movement. So there was a very nationalistic, very, just nationalistic movement within the German church in the early 1930s called the German Christian Movement, the Glaubensbewegung Deutsche Christen. And they were radically nationalistic. They were radically anti-Jewish, and they really preached a kind of simplified gospel that was inclusive of everyone, but very nationalistic, very masculine in their approach, and really threw out a lot of the traditional doctrines. And the Nazis saw this as a natural constituency to draw upon. The Deutsche Christen said when they saw the Nazis come to power, they said, well, this is a way we can become powerful too, and this is the way we can further our own agenda in German society. And there you had the marriage.
So power subsumed theology or doctrine?
Well, it many times does.
Yeah, we're talking.
And one of the things that I'm so I am, first of all, what you need to know about me is I'm a pastor myself. I love the church. I have given my life to the church, but part of my giving my life to the church is to look at its mistakes in this manner.
Which church are you ordained in, sir?
United Methodist Church.
Interesting. And that's the church I was raised in. That's the church that Dick Cheney and George Bush are members of.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
And it's also the church that has repudiated the war on Iraq, if I'm remembering correctly.
The United Methodist Council of Bishops desperately attempted to gain a meeting with Bush and Cheney prior to the war to say this runs contrary to every doctrine we preach. And the president would not meet with his own bishops, which is remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable.
We're talking to Steve Martin. He's the president of Vital Visuals Incorporated. Their website, vitalvisuals.com, a new documentary, Theologians Under Hitler. Sprechen Sie etwas Deutsch, Herr Martin? You don't speak any German.
Nein,
nur ein bisschen Deutsch. Okay, well, I want to just play a very short clip, and the reason why is I want to get your take on this. As I'm sure you know from having looked into the history of this, Hess and Hitler and these guys, when they were putting this thing together in the very early days, they were drawing a lot on the work of Georg Lanz von Liebenfels and others who were students in some ways of the Zionist movement, creating a homeland for the Jewish people in the world. And Hitler and Hess wanted to start using the word homeland to describe Heimat in German, to describe Germany rather than the traditional word Vaterland, fatherland. And here in 1934 at the Nuremberg rally is where the word homeland first appears in a big way in the whole Nazi world. This is Rudolf Hess introducing Adolf Hitler, and in German he is going to say, thanks to our Führer, that he has made it possible that Germans all over the world, Deutsche alles über die Welt, can have a Heimat, can have a homeland now here in Germany. Here's Rudolf Hess.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein. Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
Now, having heard that and having lived in Germany myself back in the 1980s for a little over a year, when George W. Bush came to power and a year later suddenly our government started using the word homeland, which we had never used before in this country in a big way, it sent chills down my spine. I'm wondering what your response is to it.
Absolutely. I mean, the rise of nationalism that we've seen in the last several years is remarkably parallel to what we saw in the early years of the Nazi period. And again, the general approach that's used is a very it's a very common approach. But the way you gel a people together, the way you solve a crisis of national identity, is to create an enemy and to create someone that's other, that must be formed against and defeated at all costs, at whatever price. And there's a very common element between between what's going on in our country in the last few years and certainly what was happening in the early Nazi period. And the idea of homeland, of course, describes this. It describes this kind of sense that we all belong to the same people, the same race,
essentially, sort of thing, is the way that Hitler was peddling it. And almost you get the sense that Bush is almost like saying, anybody who's Islamic is part of a different, you know, they're not part of our homeland, our Heimat.
Right, sure.
So it's absolutely spooky. Well, I think you guys have done a great job, and people can buy the DVD at your site, at your website?
Yes, they can, yes. And if they want to get to it very quickly, just visit www.theologiansunderhitler.com.
Theologiansunderhitler.com. Great. Thank you very much. Steve Martin, president of Vital Visuals, Reverend Steve Martin, president of Vital Visuals Incorporated, theologiansunderhitler.com. Thanks for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
Keep up the great work and keep spreading the word. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
How many wrinkles in a pickle? How many hairs in a head? How many waves in the ocean? How many crumbs in bread? But last but not least, baby, most of all, why do I mumble every time you call?
There you go, back. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. It's the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I really don't think so. Oh, it must be time to talk about Bill O'Reilly. Yes, indeed. Fox News, having a bit of a problem right now. Another sexual harassment suit. Turns out this from Media Matters. On the November 3rd broadcast of his nationally syndicated radio show, Fox host Bill O'Reilly called for a full-body search of his co-host Liz Wiehl during a conversation about a recent New York Sun editorial on a lawsuit over New York City's policy of subway bag checks. O'Reilly said, would you please bring in some security to do a full-body search on Liz Wiehl? When Wiehl repeated, I said, my bag's not my body, O'Reilly responded, full-body search on Liz Wiehl right this minute. She asked for it. She's also an author, a Harvard-trained law professor, and a legal analyst for Fox News. Apparently, you don't sexually harass somebody on the air if they're a lawyer. So it's just... here's another one. Fox News hosts Britt Hume and Bill O'Reilly recently turned their attention to their female co-hosts, remarking on their appearance, with O'Reilly asking the co-host of his nationally syndicated radio show, Liz Wiehl, to protest outside CBS studios in a bikini. Hume, appearing on Fox News' Dayside, told his co-host, Juliet Huddy, that he dressed up just for her, stating, one more chance for a man my age to be on with Juliet Huddy. I'm not sure that that's so... Well, we'll see. I'm not sure what he meant by it, actually, the more I think about it. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM, or 440-8466. Roger in Vashon Island, Washington. Hey, Roger, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I know you're quite a champion of electoral form throughout the country to clean up the electoral process. And I was wondering if you were aware of some electoral reforms that went down in strong defeat in Ohio last night.
Yeah, I'm acutely aware of them.
The Reform Ohio Now group, their reforms supported by unions, Common Cause, teachers groups, League of Women Voters, among others, were not just defeated, but were defeated soundly, anywhere from 63% to 70%.
Yep.
There were four ballot initiatives having to do with absentee voting, campaign finance reform, redistricting, and setting up a board in charge of elections instead of the Secretary of State.
Which was a repudiation of Ken Blackwell in a large part.
Yeah, and so I feel that with this huge defeat, it will now help grease the skids for Kenneth Blackwell. Kenneth Blackwell has stated in public that he holds Catherine Harris as his model for how a Secretary of State of their ilk can go on to have personal political successes.
In fact, during the 2004 election, when he was talking with reporters, a reporter said to Ken Blackwell, you know, everybody, I'm paraphrasing now, but pretty accurately, I think, said to him, you know, everybody says that Ohio is going to be this year's Florida.
Right.
And aren't you concerned about being this year's Catherine Harris? And he smiled and he said, well, look what happened to Catherine Harris.
Exactly.
And of course, she
correct.
Ended up in Congress, you know.
Exactly correct. So I had a lot of hope for these four ballot initiatives, and I feel that with their defeat, it will not only help grease the skids for Blackwell's future political career, I fear that it will allow the 2006 and 2008 elections in Ohio to look much like the corrupt elections in Ohio in 2004.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Roger.
And
in
so
fact,
my
David,
question is, since I know you're a student of electoral reform, I was wondering if you have any insights as to why the good citizens of Ohio soundly, thrashingly defeated these four ballot initiatives.
I don't. And David, our producer, David Poole, is right now working on trying to get Bob Fitrakis or Harvey Wasserman, you know, the guys from freepress.org who have been so involved in these
right.
issues, these two lawyers who actually sued the state of Ohio and
right.
Ken Blackwell over these kinds of issues, to get one of them on the program to let us know, you know, what they think happened in Ohio. Because I don't live in Ohio and I'm clueless, and I'm not, you know, broadly clueless, but, you know, unless you live there and you're involved in the middle of the politics of that particular state, I don't, you know, I just don't know, but I intend to find out, and I intend to share it with you, Roger.
I've looked at some of the newspapers, the Toledo Blade and some of those, and the articles tend to say things, they tend to interview voters who are saying things like, oh, it was just too confusing. I tried to read them, and it was just too confusing. But I go to Reform
that may well be the case.
Website, and it's all laid out perfectly succinctly and clearly to me. I don't know what the problem with voters have understanding these four initiatives.
Yeah, I'm not even going to speculate as to whether, you know, this was another hijacked election in Ohio or whether the voters
right.
were saying, hey, we're spooked enough about elections being messed with. We don't want to mess with our own elections. We might make things worse. Or whether it was whether there was a strong campaign against these things that, you know, that was well fun. I just don't know.
Okay.
And
well,
so
I very much look forward to hearing the experts that you are able to get on your program
yeah.
to help discuss this issue.
We're on it. We've been on it all day, Roger.
Okay,
and,
thank you so much.
In all probability, tomorrow or Monday, we'll get somebody on. Matt in Sacramento, we got about a half a minute. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Okay, we'll make it quick. When I called Governor Schwarzenegger's office, the response I got was a voicemail thing saying, due to circumstances beyond our control, we're not taking your call. I'll call back later. I think it was the voters that were the circumstance.
Well said, Matt. Well said.
Anyway, he's back in his cave with Conan licking his wounds. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, he'll come out growling again.
Anyway,
no doubt
God bless, and a great, great person on there before about the Germans.
Yeah, that's a real shocker, isn't it? Theologiansunderhitler.com is their website. Matt, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We got to run. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. The pill that will help you escape the Matrix, in fact. Speaking of the Matrix, the Diebold, let's see. People vote on Diebold machines, and the Diebold machines say that the people like the Diebold machines. Could be. Sue in Ashland, Ohio on the line. Hey, Sue, you have some thoughts on why Ohio rejected the voting reforms?
Yeah, and about those Diebold machines, we just got to use the new touchscreen ones yesterday. I'm totally not impressed with them. I want the paper back.
Okay.
But the four issues here that we rejected in Ohio, the first one was about absentee ballots, which they were saying would give anyone the reason to vote absentee. Well, guess what? We already have that. We just couldn't understand why they needed that. You know, we kind of, from the layman's person, that we just kind of felt there was something
fishy.
Yeah, something fishy with a couple of these, like the election reform, that committee.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who they were going to report back to? Kenny.
Uh-huh.
What would have been the point of that?
Well, then why was this supported by the League of Women Voters and progressive groups in the state?
Because the state of Ohio right now is run by Republicans. That's why I would suspect maybe some progressive groups wouldn't that, because Ohio is just in a real mess right now.
Yeah.
And this state really, in my opinion, has been going downhill ever since John Glenn left.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you. So, and John Glenn was a Republican. No, he was a Democrat.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And the thing with the special interest and that was to limit union contributions.
Right.
Yeah, and then the redistricting, you know, I really think that because Ohio has three of the top 20 most poverty-stricken cities in America, Cleveland, Toledo, and Cincinnati, and I think that maybe they wanted to redistrict those to push off that poverty to someone else. Well, we can't do nothing with it. Now you deal with it, because where I live here in Ashland, I think we would have ended up in the district in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
We're very dissimilar cities. We got absolutely nothing in common. I think we're like 25,000 here. There's a million of them in Cleveland. You can't compare them like that.
So you have different kinds of problems. You'd want different representation.
Exactly.
So, Sue, in Ashland, Ohio, you actually saw the ballot. You saw these ballot measures yesterday, and your take on them was that this doesn't seem on the up and up. It didn't seem to you like these were actual reforms that were being promoted.
And especially the one that wanted the 9-person committee to oversee our elections that would report right back to Blackwell. It was just, there was no point in that. It's like, why do you want to expand government for what you couldn't get right back last November and that, when you didn't get enough voting machines into the districts where they needed them, like Franklin County, which is Columbus, which is our state capital. They didn't have enough voting machines down there. Where were they? Sitting in a warehouse. So they had them. They just wouldn't have been. And consequently, people got tired of waiting in line and they left.
The folks in our chat room were talking about the whole point of, you know, what would be an appropriate amendment, an appropriate offering. And it seems to me like something really simple, Sue, like simply saying, the vote is part of the commons. The vote is the property of we, the people, through our elected government, and the vote shall not therefore be privatized ever under any circumstances. It shall not be handled by private corporations in secret or in any other fashion.
I agree.
Just a very simple ballot initiative like that would just put an end to a lot of this madness, it seems.
Yes, because when you have the president of Diebold that is headquartered here in Ohio saying he's going to deliver Ohio for the president of the United States in the reelection, that's nuts.
Yeah, and then it happens.
You've got to know something's up with it right then and there.
And then it happens. So did you vote against these ballot initiatives?
Yes, I did.
And you're progressive and you're all in favor of ballot reform, so you just don't think that they were strong enough. That's fascinating. Okay, Sue, thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, and thanks for listening to the program, too. Michael in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I saw something really disturbing yesterday.
Okay.
Documentary, Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre.
You're talking about the one that Italian television put together?
Right, RAI TV.
Yeah, yeah. They played last week on their all across Italy network, and then BBC picked it up and did a thing. I quoted at some length yesterday, I believe, from the BBC report on it.
Right, it was very disturbing. I noticed on Democracy Now! Yesterday on their show, which can be seen on their website.
Sure, at democracynow.org, yeah.
Right. They did an interview with some of the people that were involved with it, Jeff Englehart, the Army specialist who talks about when they were actually dropping this stuff.
Yeah. For folks who don't know what we're talking about, we invaded Iraq. Originally, Bush told us, because they were developing nuclear weapons and had the ability to attack the United States within 45 minutes. And then he said also they had when that was disproven, well, we had to topple an evil dictator. How do we know he was evil? Because he was the guy who used chemical weapons in the war against Iran and against the Kurds, you know, against his own people, arguably. First of all, it's interesting that the official CIA report on this is that the Kurds who were gassed in Halabja were probably gassed by Iranians, not Iraqis. They were sort of in between Iran and Iraq in that war. But be that as it may, he was a guy who used chemical weapons against his own people. Article 3 of the Geneva Convention specifies that phosphorus bombs, that is, these incendiary bombs, phosphorus ignites when it's exposed to the air and burns white hot, sucks oxygen out like crazy. Dropping phosphorus bombs in populated areas is a form of chemical weaponry. It's the same as dropping mustard gas or something in terms of the law. It's against the law. It's a use of chemical weapons. And apparently, we did that rather extensively in Fallujah when we took Fallujah. And that's what this documentary is about. And the whole world is in an uproar about America is using chemical weapons against Iraq when they're saying that the reason that they invaded Iraq is because they had chemical weapons.
And a Pentagon spokesperson on this show admits that they did use this.
On Amy Goodman's show.
Right, but...
Yeah, but he says they're just flares.
Yeah, that they weren't somehow a chemical weapon, and that was... It just didn't seem correct.
Well, the Italians aren't buying it, and the British aren't buying it. And you know, one more giant black mark for the United States in terms of world public opinion. It's an absolute tragedy. Michael, thanks a lot for calling and raising the issue.
Okay, and you can
also
see it on Information Clearinghouse, the full English version of that particular program.
Oh, really? Informationclearinghouse.info?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, they've got some great stuff over there. They also have the Power of Nightmares documentary, and it's which everybody should see.
Excellent program.
Yeah, it is. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Alan in Texarkana, Arkansas, on the line. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, I was wondering if, like, in the next presidential election, are the Democrats doing anything to make sure that the runoff election is going to be fair? So... If they could wind up with somebody who's really tough, who could really fight, instead of somebody who's Republican-like, like Kerry was.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean, Alan.
That.
I mean, I understand what you mean about Republican-like, but about the elections.
If somebody who really fight the Republicans instead of somebody like Kerry,
right,
and make sure that the runoff elections are fair instead of using these stupid.
By runoff, you mean primary, the primary elections? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the primary elections. That's what I meant to say.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, there is we've talked about this on this program. In fact, I think you and I have talked about this. There is a war going on right now within the Democratic Party between the Republican-lite corporatists, the pro-corporate element that Bill Clinton essentially started, the Democratic Leadership Council, although they've been part of the Democratic Party forever. I mean, he pulled them together, organized them, gave them a name. The New Democrats, or the DLC Democrats, and who, you know, I mean, the reality is in 1982, or 92 rather, Clinton looked around and said, you know, where am I going to get the money to run a presidential campaign? The unions are being killed off by the Republicans. They don't have enough money left to go up against the Republicans. And so he said, well, let's go to the corporations just like the Republicans do. And so there's that element within the Democratic Party, and then there's the element that I think in many ways Howard Dean represents, and other progressives represent in the Democratic Party, the kind of the old Wellstone element, the Russ Feingold and others, Barbara Boxer certainly, in the Democratic Party, who are saying, no, we really don't want to have anything to do with this whole DLC nonsense, and you know, we're Democrats, and that battle has not played out. It's a battle that is very much in the background. And that, frankly, in my opinion, that's the biggest problem the Democratic Party has right now, is that it has not found its voice and it has not recovered its soul, in large part because it's a house divided. And so, Alan, I think that's what it's going to take. And
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I support.
Yeah, I do, too. And I thanks for the call and thanks for raising it. Anybody who is politically active, I'm on this program every day. I encourage people to get out and get politically active. Last week, I gave a speech at the Democratic County Democratic Party of Washington County, Oregon annual meeting, their annual Neuberger banquet, which was a fundraiser. And, you know, fortunately, it was sold out. It raised some money for them. And they were saying, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, we couldn't get 12 people in a room to talk about anything other than potholes. And now there's like hundreds of people in this giant ballroom, and everybody's saying, hey, I'll toss in $20. I'll toss in $50. You know, we're going to take this party back. We're going to take back the state. We're going to take back the House. The House is in Republican hands right now here in Oregon. You know, we're going to kick out the Senator Gordon Smith, the Republican, and let's get people really fired up. I think it's absolutely great, and it is people like you and me getting involved in party politics as well as politics in general, showing up for these kinds of meetings and participating that I think is going to lead to the redemption, the recovery, the renewal, not to use too much language out of religion, of the democratic process and the Democratic Party, and ultimately of America, because some very, in my opinion, very anti-American, or at least anti-traditional American values, people have taken over this country, and it's time to take it back. You know, I'd like my country back. Thank you very much, and I'd like a country back that we can once again respect and hold up to the world as the ideal of democracy. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Explosion reported at Aman Hotel. At least five people were killed. This is from Reuters. At least five people were killed and more than 12 others wounded on Wednesday, today, in a blast in an international hotel in the Jordanian capital, Amman. A police officer said it looked like the explosion was caused by a bomb. It shook the Radisson Hotel. There's also reports that another hotel was hit. The explosion ripped through a banqueting room where about 250 people were attending a wedding reception. The hotel is known to be popular with Israeli tourists. So we'll, just listen to the radio. We'll keep you up to date. This program is going to wrap up in the next 10 minutes, but as time goes on. We have just a short minute and a half or so sound clip from today's hearings before the United States Senate. And I don't have the name of which senator this is speaking. I think it might be Dick Durbin. But anyhow, here's a give and take between one of the senators and the oil industry executives. It's fascinating to hear this.
I just want the public to know you've got $2.6 billion of tax breaks. You've told me they aren't needed. I hope you'll support my effort to take them back and give that money to people who are hurting. One last question for you, Mr. Raymond, if I might. You've been quoted as saying that speculation accounts for about $20 of the current per barrel price of oil. Yet you have given us now several times multiple kind of discussions about how the markets are working.
Well, this is interesting. So the senator is saying, hey, wait a minute. You told us speculation is driving the price up, and you're telling us the market is working. Well, speculation is part of the market, I suppose. Let's see what he says.
Shouldn't we rein in those speculators who, by your own admission, are accounting for $20 of the current per barrel price of oil in order to make markets work? Will you support legislation to rein in those speculators?
Well, I think the point, Senator, is that is part of the market. That is part of the market system. Now, in terms of
speculation, is good.
I think you will find that many times speculation is a requirement for an orderly market. Now, I'm not going to be here to defend the speculators on Wall Street. That's not my role in life.
Oh, this is Ron Wyden, David says. Okay, here we'll continue.
But I think the point I'm trying to make to you is that's an extraordinarily complex interaction to try and deal with that. And the facts are that in the petroleum markets, in the scene that has been set for the petroleum markets, the uncertainty, political, all around the world, leads to speculation, and that speculation does impact on the price of petroleum. Beyond that, what you want to try and do with it, that's up to you.
My time is up, Mr. Chairman. I'm only saying that when you yourself say that speculation is such a big factor in this clobbering people are taking at the pump, it seems to me you owe it to the public to be aggressive in terms of trying to root out some of these abuses, and I hope you'll try to do that when a group of us try to make those changes as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Interesting. There was Senator Ron Wyden in the United States Senate this morning talking about speculation in the oil industry. Fascinating stuff. Speaking of speculation, Tom DeLay has got to be speculating about what might happen if he goes to jail. This is from Mandy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. One day after death row convict escaped from a high-security Texas prison was captured in Louisiana, former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay asked today to see the fugitive's escape plan, quote, in as much detail as possible, end quote. The stunning escape of the prisoner, Charles Victor Thompson, is a matter of concern to me, said Mr. DeLay, who himself is facing criminal charges in Texas. Mr. DeLay told reporters, I think the American people have a right to know. If a convict somehow sprung himself from a Texas prison, it's important that we know exactly how he did it and whether it would be possible for somebody to do it again. End of quote. Representative DeLay said he would ask Mr. Thompson to provide detailed instructions and possibly a diagram to show exactly how it would be possible to escape from a high-security Texas prison. Additionally, the Texas congressman said if the convict's escape was facilitated by a person or persons working inside the prison itself, quote, I would like the names and telephone numbers of all those people who assisted him, end quote. But Mr. DeLay's request was rebuffed later in the day when Mr. Thompson, en route from Louisiana to Texas, told reporters, under no circumstances would I provide Tom DeLay with my escape plan. This is exactly why I didn't put my escape plan into writing, the escaped convict said. I didn't want it to fall into the wrong hands. Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Tomorrow on our program, we're going to be joined by Richard Ralston from the Ayn Rand Institute, discussing private savings accounts for healthcare, privatizing healthcare. Also joining the program will be Robert Dreyfus, giving us all the details on Ahmed Chalabi and the phony evidence he fed directly into the White House to justify the war in Iraq, why he shouldn't be the Iraqi prime minister. I think there's a larger issue here right now. Chalabi running around Washington, D.C. like he's the toast of the town. And a lot of people saying, hey, wait a minute, how come this guy is not being subpoenaed? How come he's not testifying before before Congress? How come he's not testifying? How come the FBI has not arrested him? I mean, you know, here we have Ahmed Chalabi, the guy who is accused of leaking our secrets to Iran, with whom we're talking about going to war, and he's rented eight suites at the Four Seasons Hotel in Washington, D.C., and he's meeting with Condoleezza Rice like he's a visiting head of state. And the guy, and this is a guy who, by the way, is convicted of bank robbery or bank fraud in Jordan and sentenced to 27 years of hard labor. He's a fugitive from justice in Jordan. He facilitated lies to Dick Cheney that were used to get us into the war in Iraq. He runs to Iran when he gets outed for this by the CIA. He's apparently been feeding our secrets to Iran, and he's got a date with Condi. What's going on? Well, I can tell you what's going on. It's treason in the White House, and it has been going on all along. Iran wanted Saddam Hussein out of power. He was a thorn in their side. He was running a secular government. They wanted the Shia population there to have a religious government governed by the mullahs. And so they got us to get him out. Bush was Iran's sucker, and Chalabi was the tool to make it happen. And now Bush can't back down from that. He looks stupid, and so Chalabi, they're just going to have to go along with it, I'm guessing is what's going to happen. Because they tried to take him out. It didn't work. He fought back. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place, my friends. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.